The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth!
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great, and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive!
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerker's Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
If Patrick Henry were still alive, he would listen to the Constitution Hour, featuring Professor Kevin Gutzman. Debuting every Wednesday at noon Central, here on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Welcome to the inaugural episode here of the Constitution Hour, featuring my good friend, Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. We will be doing this show once per week to start. We invite you to go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com and look up the Constitution Hour featuring Kevin Gutzman page and send your Constitution or American history questions in. And we'll do our best to get all of your questions in every week during the show. So our goal here is to entertain you and to inform you and to demolish the myths that you have had inculcated into your brain throughout the course of your childhood and your adult life, because the U.S. Constitution, as it's taught, is very rarely taught properly. And if it is, well, then you're probably attending classes with Professor Gutzman. So, having said all that, I'd like to introduce you to our host, the one and only Professor Kevin Gutzman. He is the author of James Madison and the Making of America, a great book that's still on sale. You can still get it in our store at VeritasRadioNetwork.com and at Amazon. He's also the author of Virginia's American Revolution. That's a great book about Virginia history. And also the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution. So, Professor Gutzman, here we are, episode one. How are you feeling today, old friend?
Very well, Mike. How are you?
I am very well. I'm very excited about our little venture here. Before we get off and to start answering questions, just for people that were not familiar with my show on the old station in the old country and may not be familiar with you and your career, you are a Texas native, right?
Actually, no, I'm an Army brat, but I went to junior high, high school, college, law school in Texas.
So, and then from Texas, University of Virginia, right?
That's right, yes. I got my MA and PhD in American history at UVA.
And then from UVA, then to where you're currently at, or was there a stop in between?
No, I actually have lived in Connecticut, which is where I am at the moment, since I graduated from UVA in 1999.
And Virginia's U.S. History, your first book, when did you decide to write that, or what year did it come out?
Well, it's a revised version of my doctoral dissertation, and it was published in 2007. So what you're going to find in that book is an explanation of the way that Virginians decided to remake their society as part of the American Revolution. So getting rid of the king's authority was just the start of the American Revolution. What really shaped the futures of the people who lived in Virginia at the time was the way that they decided to remake their laws now that they had Republican government. So, for example, throwing out the king had obvious repercussions in the area of religion in Virginia, because the king was the head of the Church of England, which had been in Virginia and in seven other states, the official church during the colonial period. So Virginians debated and ultimately decided to get rid of their longtime establishment of the Church of England. And there are several other issues like that. Most interestingly, maybe federalism, but there are several other questions that the book shows Virginians debating. And I think actually this is what the revolution was really about. It wasn't really about having a war or even setting up a federal government, but deciding how each of these 13 quote-unquote free and independent states would be shaped now that people who lived there were free to shape them in any way they wanted.
Well, they thought in 1776, when Virginia would have made the first state to declare its independence, you write about that in the book, they thought that they were independent, but by the time they ratify the Constitution and they start living under it, as soon as ratification has taken place and Virginia is now part of the Union, one of the subjects that we'll cover today is one of the very, very early episodes where Virginians actually had to confront. I'll use a little flourish here. They actually had to confront the monster that they had created. And there might have even been some that thought that it was a monster. Is that fair?
Oh, well, actually, if you're referring to the federal government, sure.
Yes.
People were not sanguine that the federal government would turn out well, that the experiment in a closer relationship with the other 12 states would turn out well, but they were persuaded to enter into the federal union by arguments that clearly the status quo, in which it was impossible for the United States to raise an army or pay soldiers or conduct diplomatic relations with foreign countries, was simply untenable, that there had to be some kind of change. So the people in Virginia's political elite entered into the new union very trepidatiously, and within a few months they were sure that they had been right to be fearful.
And when you say within a few months, this is within a few months after the first Congress starts, or does it start to fall apart even in between, or start to become menacing in between?
Well, virtually as soon as the first Congress met, the Congress asked the new Treasury Secretary to submit his plans for the finances of the federal government. And one proposal that the Treasury Secretary, who turned out to be Alexander Hamilton, made was that the federal government should assume responsibility for all the debts the states had incurred in funding the revolution. So at that time, Congress did assume responsibility for state debts, and then the Virginia legislature instantly responded with resolutions saying, well, you told us that this new government would only have the powers that were expressly delegated, but we don't see anything in the Constitution expressly delegating Congress power to take responsibility for the debts of Georgia and New Hampshire and Pennsylvania and so on. So we think that you're already abusing the powers we've given you, and we're going to keep an eye on you. We're not going to allow this to work out this way.
You know, one of the things, I never got to ask you this question, I don't think that I did, and as you're talking about this story, I'm just wondering, the historian, as he's called, Joseph Ellis, in a book called Founding Brothers, and there's a chapter in there. The first chapter in the book is details kind of the behind-the-scenes story of how this assumption came about. You're completing a book right now on the political philosophy of Thomas Jefferson. Ellis claims that Jefferson, who I guess would have been Secretary of State then, and Madison and Washington had some sort of a dinner meeting with Hamilton and Adams and others to cook this plan up. From your experience and what you've researched, how accurate or inaccurate is that?
Well, Ellis gets the story from Thomas Jefferson's Annus, A-N-A-S, which is a collection he made while he was Secretary of State of notes of conversations he had with other important people in the federal government. So Jefferson says that one day as he was leaving the president's house, he encountered Secretary Hamilton, who uncharacteristically was disheveled and muttering to himself, and asking him what the problem was. Jefferson heard that Hamilton thought that if the federal government didn't assume responsibility for state debts, his whole financial plan would be ruined. And so Jefferson told Hamilton, well, don't worry about this. Actually, what I can do is I'll have Congressman Madison meet the two of us for dinner at my house tomorrow, and we can talk about this. And so, according to Jefferson, Hamilton and Madison worked out a deal, the terms of which were that Madison and a couple of other Virginians would stop voting no on assumption of state debts. And in return for their not voting no anymore, Hamilton would persuade the Pennsylvania senators to support the idea that ultimately the seat of the federal government should be on the Potomac, or in other words, that ultimately the capital should be what we now call the District of Columbia, which is today in land that was given to the Congress by to the federal government by Maryland.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a true story insofar as we know. We don't have an account from either of the other two guys saying it's not true. And, it, of course, Congress immediately behaved as if it were true by adopting legislation assuming state debts and providing that the capital should be moved to the Potomac. So, yeah, I think that's right. And in general, Ellis is a reliable historian.
Well, I asked the question because some of the stories that have come out of Professor Ellis's books, there have been other questions that were asked about it. And one of the things that we're going to talk about here today and at the end of the show may touch upon that. So I was just curious. I had never got a chance to ask the question. Now, you closed your comment with, well, then Congress then went and proceeded as though they had the power to assume state debts. And they've never repeated that error since, have they?
No, I think that people in Congress generally are sticklers for the Constitution and never would violate it unless they were mistaken about its meaning.
We are, of course, being very facetious here. You're listening to the inaugural, the debut episode of the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. I am the co-host here and your moderator, Mike Church. And we will field questions from the audience every week when we do this. Just go to the VeritasRadioNetwork.com page and look for the Constitution Hour featuring Kevin Gutzman, and you can send your questions there. Or to Kevin via Facebook, you can find him at Kevin Gutzman, or me, Mike Church Show fan page. Kevin, let's go to question number one, which I think was a pretty good one here. This comes to us from Drew McTeague, and the question is this. Mike, can you ask the doctor to explain the relationship between the Ninth and Tenth Amendment as it relates to federalism? Now, I assume that, or I take it that what he means is, do the Ninth and the Tenth Amendments, they are federalist amendments, meaning that they were meant to sort of make sure that there was a separation between the state powers and the federal powers. And I'll let you run with it because I have a follow-up question to this.
Well, in 2008, our friend Tom Woods and I co-authored a book called Who Killed the Constitution? And one contribution we hoped to make to public discussion by publishing that book was that we hoped our inclusion of the preamble to the Bill of Rights in the appendix with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights would get people to thinking about what the Bill of Rights was actually supposed to do. Nowadays, of course, the Bill of Rights, the term the Bill of Rights, is used to justify federal courts' vetoes over any state laws they don't like. So they say that the Bill of Rights empowers them to have a kind of roving supervisory authority over state legislatures. But actually, as the preamble to the Bill of Rights shows, the intention of the people who sent the Bill of Rights out to the states to be ratified in 1789 was exactly opposite. Far from granting a new power to federal courts, the Bill of Rights was intended to clarify limits on the powers of the federal government generally. So rather than giving the federal government a supervisory power over state governments, as we now think of the Bill of Rights as doing, it was intended further to check the powers of the federal government. And so what the preamble to the Bill of Rights says is that because in the ratification process, so many people had expressed their unhappiness with the apparent lack of clarity of the limits to the federal government's power, these proposed amendments were being sent to the states further to clarify the limits on federal power. And the most important amendment in that sense is the 10th Amendment. Actually, this is one that's often overlooked, but when Thomas Jefferson first came to give an authoritative reading of the of the Constitution in his 1791 memorandum on Hamilton's bank bill for President Washington, Jefferson began by saying, well, I understand that the underlying principle of the federal Constitution is whatever powers are not granted to this government by the Constitution or denied by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And, of course, we now know that language as the Tenth Amendment.
Right.
You know, as a Jefferson scholar, I don't have to be reading that. I know it because it's just ubiquitous in Jeffersonian's accounts of the federal government and in the disputes of the 1790s and the first decade of the 19th century over the behavior of the federal government and the policies it should adopt. So the chief principle of the Bill of Rights was that, yes, the new Constitution was only granting Congress and federal courts in the enumerated powers, and if that weren't already clear enough, that's exactly what the Tenth Amendment says. The Ninth Amendment, on the other hand, addresses a problem that some Federalists raised in the process of having the Constitution ratified and then proposing amendments. So in 1787 in Philadelphia, delegates from 12 states met and wrote the U.S. Constitution. At the very end of the Philadelphia Convention in September, a couple of delegates, most notably George Mason of Virginia, the chief author of Virginia's Constitution of 1776 and its Virginia Declaration of Rights of 1776, said, well, we need to have a Bill of Rights. We can't send this Constitution to the states for their ratification without including a Bill of Rights. Other members of the Philadelphia Convention said, no, that's not a good idea for a couple of reasons. One is, we've been here all summer. We've done a lot of work. I'm really ready to go home. Another one was, well, we don't really need a Bill of Rights because this government is only going to have the enumerated powers. So you don't need to take a constitution that doesn't say Congress can establish a national church and add a provision that says Congress can't establish a national church because the understanding is that Congress will only have the enumerated powers. Mason and Governor Edmund Randolph of Virginia and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts replied, well, no, this is just an unsatisfactory answer. We actually always need to have express statements that particular classic rights of Englishmen are going to be respected by American governments. And then So the Philadelphia Convention rejected this argument for a Bill of Rights and sent the Constitution to the Congress, which ultimately forwarded it to the states for their ratification. When you got to the states in the ratification process, some Federalists added the argument that, well, we shouldn't have a Bill of Rights because we have an English legal principle that whatever isn't included in a list is excluded. So if we started saying Congress has to respect the following 4, 12, 26, however many rights, the understanding, according to this English legal maxim, would be that whatever wasn't included in that list would be excluded. In other words, if you didn't think of all the rights of Americans, the assumption would be that if they weren't named in the Bill of Rights, then they didn't have to be respected anymore. And so what the Ninth Amendment says is, well, essentially, we understand that this is a principle, but the fact that a right is not included in the Bill of Rights does not mean that it's not to be respected anymore. So these are essentially, both of these amendments are about federalism. They're about the idea that the federal government only has a few powers, that the traditional rights of individuals and the rights of the states, which are sovereign communities of individuals, are to be respected by the federal government.
And the language that was attached to the preamble for the Bill of Rights, I have it right here, and I'd just like to read it to the audience so we have a little bit more of a clear understanding of what Kevin is talking about here. It says this: the conventions of a number of the states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground to public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. And it's resolved, and then it gives the articles. It's sent to the states for ratification, 12 articles. And what people might find really interesting about this, Kevin, is that at the start of the Bill of Rights, as it was sent out for ratification, I don't know that this puts it in matter of importance or not, but the First Amendment that is attached is the one that is the only one that remains not ratified, and that's the one that would change the proportional representation in Congress to not one representative for less than 30,000, or is it less than more than 30,000, less than 40,000. So we'd have about 7,900 members of Congress today had amendment or Article the First been ratified. Any comment on that?
Well, I think what's more interesting about that is that the other one that wasn't, the other one of those 12 that wasn't ratified in 1791 actually ultimately was ratified in 1992. So most people don't realize that James Madison wrote a constitutional amendment that was ratified in 1992. And the way that that happened was that in the 1970s, there was a fellow working in the Texas legislature who happened to be poring over old recommended amendments and realized that there was this amendment from the first Congress that had been ratified by some of the states, but not an adequate number to become part of the Constitution. And so this clerk in the Texas legislature started using his own money for postage and envelopes and so on, sending letters to legislators all over the country in states that had never ratified this proposed amendment. And ultimately, in 1992, he had persuaded a sufficient number of states to adopt this amendment that it became part of the Constitution. So who says one person can't have a gigantic effect? That amendment had been essentially forgotten up to that point. And of course, it's not a super important amendment, but it does establish a good principle that Congress can't give itself a pay raise before an election intervenes. So people had the worry that members of Congress would go off to the Capitol, you know, vote that each of them gets $1 billion and then go back home. And even if you could vote them out, well, each of them had his $1 billion. So what the amendment says is essentially, well, if they're going to vote themselves each $1 billion, we have to get a chance to vote them out before they can get the money, which means, of course, they're not going to do that. So this was Madison's idea. It's one of the amendments he had in mind before Congress even began discussing them. And then, as I say, it became part of the Constitution in 1992.
So maybe if we could find some similar inertia for the ratification of Article the First. Of course, there was supposed to be a problem with that, something about the language that the math could be construed to not mean one representative for every 30,000, not less than 30,000 and not more than 40,000. Somehow there is a misplaced preposition in the amendment, and that's why they didn't ratify it. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, as I understand it, there's a lack of clarity over the question whether this was supposed to be a limit or a minimum. It seems more logical that it's a minimum.
Right.
But, I'm not sure.
Okay, so the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. We are just about finished with our first segment. And what we'll do is we'll take a little bit of a break here, and we'll come back and we'll have more questions, more answers coming up later on in the show. We have, talking about the, speaking of the Bill of Rights, on December the 15th, before this next episode number two of this show airs, will be Bill of Rights Day. That's the day the Bill of Rights was ratified. We have a little discussion about that. And also, we'll celebrate or commemorate on December the 13th every year, the day that the Virginia Assembly met to discuss what we call nullification and interposition today, what basically was an attempt by Virginia to try and stop the federal government from enforcing the Alien and Sedition Acts. So we've got a lot of exciting, great radio coming your way here. This is the Veritas Radio Network. This is the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Kevin Gutzman. I'm your moderator, Mike Church, and we shall return right after these brief messages.
The professor is in. Send your questions for Professor Kevin Gutzman to Constitution@VeritasRadioNetwork.com.